Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. There's more to hemp than mood-altering substances. Hemp's strong fibers and oil seeds make it a good alternative to petrochemicals, and scientists at the Alberta Research Council are on the verge of launching hemp into the plastics market. And if the work of biochemists Dr. Nat Cave and Dr. Michael James is a success, they may soon have an edible vaccine to prevent mad cow disease in livestock. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The Alberta Research Council has just launched a $2.25 million project, and that will promote hemp as a viable feedstock to produce polymers or plastics. The Research Council has actually been studying hemp for over a decade. Its long, strong fibers and oil seeds make hemp a very attractive crop for a variety of products. What's needed now is the economic infrastructure to support it. Heading up the project is Dr. John Wolodko, a scientist in the ARC's biocomposite program.
The objective is to just that, to utilize hemp fiber and incorporate it into reinforced plastics for products. But the Alberta Research Council, that $2.25 million extends from what we call from seed to final product. The ARC's team is probably the largest biofiber research team in Canada. And so we have world-class scientists working on everything from agronomics, so that's growing the hemp, best practices to do so, to genomics, so better engineer hemp fiber from the ground up, to processing, so understanding what's the best methods to actually process this fiber. And we have a pilot scale facility to do that. And then I'm at the end of the row where we basically take that fiber and try to develop components and parts and what's the best processing methods to do that, and work with end customers to take that product to market. So it's really a complete chain.
Well, what is it about hemp that makes it suitable for this sort of work?
Well, from the fiber point of view, hemp is inherently has very strong natural fibers in it. And, you know, man has been using it for over 10,000 years in making both cloth, durable cloth, and rope, for example. So it's not necessarily anything new. What is new, I guess, is the incorporation in more novel, newer products that exist today, as well as the technologies are changing to assist in that manner. So I think the big focus is ultimately we are now reverting back to more green products. You know, there's a push these days for sustainability and environmental consciousness, and by growing hemp and utilizing fibers, it is a renewable source.
What could some of those end products be?
End products can be anything you envision with plastic materials. It could be everything from car parts, automotive parts, aerospace, consumer products, sporting goods, you name it. Anything with plastics could potentially be made with hemp-reinforced natural fibers.
So what are some of the things that you're working on now to actually get it out into the marketplace?
Well, this particular project is being sponsored. Our industrial sponsors are AT Plastics in Edmonton here. They are a polyethylene manufacturer and processor. So we're working with them, and hopefully that the products that we develop from this can be taken forward through their supply chain and their customers to see a potential advantage in some of the products that are produced. We're also working with Naturally Advanced Technologies out of Vancouver, and they've been a big proponent of developing novel uses for hemp in industrial applications. And down the road, we see that, you know, we're trying to create basically an infrastructure here.
Well, even though hemp is an old plant and an old fiber, it's fallen out of favor. Now it's coming back into favor. Why did we stop growing it in the first place?
There's probably a few reasons for that. One is the stigma attached with hemp in the first place, and a reluctance to use an illicit drug. However, the hemp we're talking about is industrial hemp, which is very low THC value. Also, probably the other reason, too, is the proliferation of man-made synthetic materials, and predominantly from petrochemical feedstocks. Now we're getting to a situation where things are coming back, again, as we said, on a green front, where you have this desire to have more sustainable products, renewable resources. But also feedstocks for petrochemicals are increasing, the price is increasing, and we are looking for alternatives. So hemp provides a very good alternative to that.
What do you have to do to the hemp in order to make it useful to turn it into a polymer or a plastic?
Hemp is an interesting crop in the sense that they call it a dual-purpose crop. And to answer that question, hemp can produce oil seed, which can be utilized for food and cosmetics, and you can take the oil seed also to manufacture what we call biopolymers. So you can use it as a feedstock down the road in terms of chemical processing. And the fiber material then can be used from the stock is a very strong, tough fiber, which can be utilized directly in reinforcing plastics. So it can be a component that's added to plastics to increase their strength, decrease their weight, potentially decrease the cost of the actual component of the part.
Now, are there any farmers growing it right now?
There are some. It's a licensed, it's a restricted crop, so you do have to obtain a license to grow it, which I don't think is necessarily a hindrance, because if you can provide an economic outlet, then farmers will grow that crop. I think right now what's happening, there's a relatively small amount of hectares grown in terms of hemp when you compare it to other cash crops such as canola. But that's really what the purpose of our program is about, to try to change that, to try to develop this infrastructure that exists. It's a chicken and the egg situation. Farmers don't want to grow the crop because they have nowhere to sell it to. Manufacturers don't want to use fibers necessarily because there's no fixed supply in place. So the ARC is here really to provide this stimulation to the economy to take this forward.
How long do you think that will take?
Well, actually, hemp and hemp products are already in use in Europe. There are auto manufacturers using hemp in their car parts. They're probably about 5 to 10 years ahead of us in that regard. So it's actually happening around the world right now. In terms of an Alberta-based economy, we're hoping that we can envision something on a shorter time period, 3 to 5 years, that we can actually have products sent to market that are based on hemp-reinforced plastics.
What are some of the challenges that you have to overcome right now in terms of the science, the research, and getting it out there? Because you've given yourself a very short window here to try and get it out into the marketplace.
The challenges, which I think can be addressed, is number one, which a lot of the scientists here at ARC have already taken forward, is how do you process this on a large scale to make it economic? And they've developed technologies here that have done just that. So I think that's very feasible. From the science point of view of incorporating into materials, the thing that we have to overcome is issues such as variability. Of course, a natural fiber relative to a man-made fiber is going to have a lot more variability in it. So that might dictate exactly where you put that part in service. There's also questions regarding how do you make that fiber last a long time? You know, what's the degradation? Will there be any propensity to absorb moisture, etc.? And these are some of the topics that we will be basically working on to try to improve these products.
John, you have a couple of samples here of some of the plastics. One is brown and one is more of an opaque. What's the difference between these two?
Well, the opaque is really it's an unreinforced polyethylene sheet, and it is very flexible. And when we add the fibers, what the fibers do is ultimately reinforce it. So as you can see, it's a lot stiffer, it's harder to bend, adds a lot more strength to the product. One of the challenges that we are trying to address with trying to develop a product like this is the nature of the fiber versus the nature of the polymer. The fibers themselves are hydrophilic, so they have a propensity to try to absorb moisture. The polyethylene and the polymers, on the other hand, are hydrophobic, so they try to resist absorbing water and moisture. And due to the nature of that chemistry, there's an incompatibility. They don't really want to bond together. And part of our process is to try to develop technologies, treatments, potentially using coupling agents to enhance that bond together to make a stronger product and a more durable product here.
Well, it sounds like exciting work. Thank you very much, John.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. John Wolodko, project leader for the Polymers and Composites Program at the Alberta Research Council. At the present time, there is no cure for prion diseases like mad cow, scrapie's chronic wasting disease, or Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. Prions are ancient proteins present in most animals. Scientists are still trying to understand what their purpose may be, but they do know that when something goes wrong with prions, they misfold, and this misfolding sets off a chain reaction of self-replication that infects and ultimately kills the host. As well, because prions are natural to animals and humans, we don't produce antibodies against them. But that situation has changed thanks to the help of a genetically engineered mouse, and prion researchers at the University of Alberta, Dr. Nat Cav and Dr. Michael James, hope their work will ultimately produce a vaccine. I spoke first with Michael about his role in the project.
We're collaborating with Dr. Nat Cav and also a group in Switzerland. And the group in Switzerland has made a number of monoclonal antibodies that are directed against certain regions of the unfolded part of the prion protein. And our project is to make smaller versions of those antibodies so that they're more amenable to three-dimensional structure determination, and determine the structures of the antibodies by X-ray crystallography, and also the complexes of the small portions of the unfolded prion protein complexed with these small antibodies.
What's the point of doing that?
Well, we hope to gain an insight into the three-dimensional structure of this unfolded part of the prion protein, which seems to be an important determinant in the whole of the prion disease.
Now, how were these antigens developed in the first place?
They were developed. The antigens are small peptides that are placed into mice. And the mouse's innate immune system produces the antibodies directed against these small peptides. These mice are special mice that are called hybridomas, and they have a cancer which produces a monoclonal antibody specifically for these. It's not something that we have in our bodies or cows have there either. If you have a monoclonal antibody that's been raised against a specific protein, it recognizes that protein and no others. And it's a very powerful tool for analysis of complex mixtures of proteins. You can pick your protein out and leave all the others behind by using a monoclonal antibody.
So in this case, normally the body wouldn't recognize the misfolded proteins, but with this mouse, now it will.
Yeah, with the mouse, Agouti specifically removed the prion protein it's a knockout mouse that doesn't make the prion protein. So now we can inject, or they injected, portions of misfolded prion protein, the N-terminal part of the molecule, and then the mouse thinks that that's an anthropomorphic term, but the mouse recognizes that as foreign and will make an antibody against it, whereas if it had its own prion present, it wouldn't do anything against it.
Now, what are you actually going to do in order to, do your analysis and try and figure out how this is all working?
Well, X-ray crystallography depends on the ability to produce crystals of highly purified protein. So in collaboration with Dr. Cav, we will make highly purified small versions of the antibodies and then attempt to crystallize them. We will also attempt to crystallize them in a complex with the what's known as the epitope, the small region of the prion protein against which these antibodies are raised, so that we can see how the three-dimensional structure of those small regions folds. It's a standard technique in protein crystallography to, once you have the crystals, to put them in an X-ray beam, and in this case we will use the synchrotron radiation, very intense radiation, either in Saskatoon or in Berkeley, California, where we have an agreement. And it's the Alberta Synchrotron Institute that funds some of that research as well. So you collect the data, and then you determine what the molecules look like in these crystals.
So once you've determined what these structures are, what happens then?
Well, from my perspective, there's the possibility of developing small molecules that will prevent the misfolding of the prion protein and form complexes with this portion of the prion protein that will then leave it in a normal folded state. There are other ways of doing prion protein treatment, and I'll leave that to Dr. Cav to talk about.
When do you expect to see some results?
Well, we're hopeful. This grant is for a year, and we hope that we'll get some results fairly shortly.
Thank you very much, Michael.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Michael James, a professor of biochemistry at the University of Alberta. He's collaborating with Dr. Nat Cav, who's also a professor of biochemistry in the Department of Agriculture and Nutritional Science at the University of Alberta.
An important part of the structural work that Dr. James is doing requires the antibodies that are the smaller versions of the monoclonal antibodies that Professor James was talking about. Our group makes those smaller versions of antibodies. We have the techniques in our laboratory to be able to take an antibody that is really, really large, which is what mice cells that Professor Aguzzi developed produce, and we take those and we take the genes for the smaller versions of these antibodies, and we produce, using those genes, large amounts of those antibodies in bacteria, which we supply to Professor James to do the crystal structure and crystallography. We also take those genes and put them in plants so that we can make these antibodies in plants, which could be used as an edible sort of passive vaccine for animals and perhaps humans as well to combat prion diseases. So that's the longer term objective.
So what you're saying is that if you can develop a vaccine from these plant antibodies, say perhaps in the future, in order to prevent mad cow disease, the cows could chow down on some crop that has these antibodies in it?
That's the vision. I mean, historically, it's been demonstrated that passively administering antibodies against pathogens can prevent the disease. So it should be theoretically possible to let the animals graze on a field of antibody-producing plants, and those animals would be protected from any infection that could arise from contaminated feed or whatever the case may be. So that would be the longer term.
Are there any particular plants that are good for this?
If we were to feed antibodies that work to prevent the onset of BSC in cattle, if we have demonstrated all that, then we need it to be in a plant that is actually used to feed cattle. This would be after we have shown that the antibody is effective, the antibody can successfully get through the digestive tract of the animal and is able to prevent the disease. Then we would be looking at crops that are used to feed cattle. Barley comes to mind, perhaps canola protein as a supplement comes to mind, soy protein comes to mind, but these are, I would say, any plant that is used to feed cattle would work.
Now, this antibody thing, though, is it's rather new. Because we haven't seen those before in animals or people who have exhibited these diseases.
Yes, that's the problem that had been an issue with respect to prion biologists worldwide. Prion proteins normally are found in every cell in living organisms, in mammals anyway, and also in certain types of yeasts, prion-like proteins occur. So that innate immune system does not recognize the prion protein, whether it's the normal form or the misfolded form. It doesn't recognize it as foreign, and therefore the immune system is unable to deal with it. So Professor Aguzzi, when he made these antibodies, had to work with mice that were specifically prion protein deficient. And so when he injected them with the prion protein, the mice's immune system recognized it has foreign and produced antibodies. And so that was very important for all of this work.
Is it only plants, or can you use this in other things?
Yes, we produce those antibodies in bacteria as well, in the laboratory strains of bacteria. So conceivably, one could purify it in a pure form, and that pure form could be formulated with pharmaceutical chemists and could be administered in different ways. So you don't really have to have an edible form of the vaccine. It could be a pharmaceutical preparation.
How are you going to carry out your experiments to see if these actually work?
These antibodies, once we have them in the pure form, we will be sending them to Professor Aguzzi, who has got various mice models of prion diseases. They range from BSC models to chronic wasting disease models to scrapie models, all sorts of mice models. Our objective would be to take these antibodies, and Aguzzi's group would be administering them to these mice. Normal mice, chronically infected mice, mice that don't exhibit symptoms but are subclinical, and see whether they delay symptom onset, whether they alleviate symptoms that are already there, whether they prevent a challenge or infection by the infective form of the prion protein. So these are the things that we would be doing. We have enough antibody, at least one type of those among the 20 that we are trying to generate. There is at least one that we have in a pure form that we are in the process of supplying to Professor Aguzzi, and he will be his group will be testing whether they have any therapeutic effects. And so we propose to do that with the rest of the antibodies over the longer term, that would be beyond the year of funding that we have, and identify those antibodies that have potential as therapeutic agents.
What progress have you made so far?
We have taken the hybridoma cell lines that Professor Aguzzi made, which contain the larger antibodies. We have taken the 20 of them, and we have made the smaller versions for at least 3 to 5 of those antibody molecules. We have purified at least one of them, and we are just about ready to begin the mice testing. We have introduced the gene into the plant for this one particular antibody, so we will be in a position to test those plants. All that is funded by the Alberta Prion Research Institute, and we'll be able to do that within the next 8-9 months.
What is the significance of all this work when you look at everything that's going on in terms of trying to figure out what causes these misfolded prions?
I think the significance there is that we have access through our collaboration with Professor Aguzzi to a series of antibodies that recognize a very important part of the prion protein. So using them as tools and using them in the structural analysis that Professor James was talking about will tell us a lot about, or has the potential to tell us a lot about, the unstructured first part of the prion protein, which appears to be important. So that's the significance.
You've just returned from an international conference on prions and prion folding diseases. What's happening now? What's coming up on the horizon?
What's coming up on the horizon? Improved techniques for the purification of the infective form of the prion protein. That was a big thing at that meeting. Still, the biggest challenge appears to be we don't know how the protein, prion protein, leads to disease. There is all kinds of theories and hypotheses, but we are far from understanding this protein fully.
Why do you think it's so hard to find out?
Because it has been a challenge from the beginning when Stan Prusiner first proposed that this was a protein-mediated disease, unlike diseases that have been transmitted through viruses or genetic material like DNA, RNA. Here, there was a protein that was reproducing itself. So this has been a challenge to our understanding, our dogma, the dogma that is that proteins don't duplicate themselves without the aid of genetic material like DNA and RNA. This seems to be self-propagating, and that is the biggest challenge because this is taking us into territories where we still have to generate the knowledge.
Thank you very much, Nat.
Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Nat Cav, a professor of biochemistry in the Department of Agriculture and Nutritional Science at the University of Alberta. The research of Dr. Cav and Dr. Michael James is supported in part by PrionNet and the Alberta Prion Research Institute. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during the program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Research Council, Alberta Ingenuity, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Genome Alberta, the Alberta Conservation Association, the University of Lethbridge, and the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Crocher.